Welcome back to the Hemingway List, the podcast where we do things the Hemingway. Today we will be discussing the second last chapter, chapter 33 of Wuthering Heights, and then we'll be reading the last chapter, which means tomorrow is a double episode day. So what we'll be doing tomorrow is having the recap episode, where we will discuss chapter 34 and the book on the whole of Wuthering Heights. So that's sort of the final Wuthering Heights episode. And then we will be having the first episode in the Brothers Karamazov series, which will be just sort of an introduction to the book and reading the first chapter. Obviously, we won't be discussing that chapter yet, so that'll be opening the discussion forum for the first chapter. And then we'll continue on from there. So, big things ahead. A lot of new subscribers. I saw a little boost up in the subscriber count on the Hemingway List subreddit. So I think it might be a bit early to say welcome, because they're probably going to tune into tomorrow's episode when we start the new book. But hey, welcome anyway, if you are listening. Very exciting stuff. All right, so let's jump into the chapter 33 discussion. The questions that I asked you were these ones. Is Mr. Heathcliff dead? What? I'm so confused. So at this late juncture, who is Lockwood? Just a man passing through? Do you think Harriton would fight Heathcliff if Heathcliff struck Cathy? Savvy Kid said, so no, definitely not. Heathcliff isn't dead. I'm still confused. I don't know if we've gone back to reflect on how he died and that's why he seems to be alive again, or if he just didn't die and we misinterpreted that bit from a couple of chapters ago. I'm a little bit confused there. And who is Lockwood? Savvy Kid said, Lockwood's character is merely the vessel that the tale is being communicated through. Definitely an odd thing to do, but also an interesting choice on Bronte's part. The presence of Lockwood reminds me of a person's own natural connections to people they encounter for only short periods of time. Each person or family have their own intricate history, some histories which we may never know about. Lockwood just seems to be in the right place at the right time with the right mouthy housekeeper who told him the story of the family she serves. And lastly, it's difficult to say, would Harriton fight Heathcliff? Did you hear that? I wonder if you heard that. It scared the hell out of me. That was a possum fight, I believe. That sounds like the telltale sounds of a possum fight happening outside my window. That made me jump out of my chair just about. This is difficult to say. I want to say yes, but I know that Harriton has been trained into submission by Heathcliff for much longer than him and Cathy have been close. I think Harriton holds on to affection for Heathcliff because he is the only companion, sort of, he had for so long. I think he would be angry but wouldn't actually stop Heathcliff from doing anything because he hasn't so far. Techrific said, Heathcliff can't handle the reality of Harriton and Cathy. Harriton reminds him of Catherine so much that he can't bear to look at him any more, and he ventures out to seek solitude. We see a breakdown happen here. Heathcliff is losing his will to live, and he even stops eating. So this rapid decline is what led to his demise. Nally is back as narrator, and true to form, goes into a lengthy description of Heathcliff's mental state and his rapid decline. So we can surmise this is what led him to expire. Yeah, that's what I figured as well, Tech, is it? He is dead, but she's now recounting the lead-up to his death, which is why she's speaking as if he's still alive. A little bit confusing. Like we've discussed before, it becomes evident that Lockwood has just been the convenient stand-in for the readers all along, and I'm kind of fine with it. At this late stage, to make him anything but a side character would be shocking, so I wouldn't put it past Emily, but I don't believe it. I agree with Savvy Kid that Harriton would have had a hard time standing up to Heathcliff, being the only real father figure he had, albeit a grotesque caricature of one. Harriton's loyalty and gratitude I know it's absurd, but there we have it. Gratitude would stop his hand. Wasm said, it looks like Heathcliff works himself into a sickness. Finally, his feelings catch up with him, or at least is revealed to the outside. Tech said, indeed, I think the latter is more plausible. The shit has festered too long, and now he can't hide it any more. Gwynardle said, it was such a relief to get a little bit of self-reflection from Heathcliff right at the end. It made me realise how much our opinion of him was shaped by Nally being the narrator. It is clear that he has been in absolute agony for most of his life, and he admits that it is because of his own obsession. If the story were told from his point of view, I wonder if he would seem like such a monster. He was a monster. And the thing that I thought just now while reading your comment, Gwynardle, is he hung on to his grief and his torment for so long, and he agonized over it, and that is why he was in agony for most of his life, because he agonized, funnily enough. And as I was reading your comment, I was just thinking, man, you know what? A little bit of therapy, or maybe a lot of therapy, and the right professional treatment for him at the time that he was grieving, at the time that things weren't going his way, a good 20 years ago, and he might have gotten past this obsession. They would have recognized it as an unhealthy obsession and said, hey, look, you know, you lost a loved one, you didn't get what you wanted, you're heartbroken. This is the right course of action to move past it. And then he would have moved past it. But, hey, back then, I suppose they didn't have the know-how, the knowledge, the medication, maybe, if he may have needed that. Whatever he needed, just the techniques, the therapy techniques that would have helped him. And, I don't know, it's a bit of a sad thing, but at the same time, he's got to be accountable for all the horrible things he's done. So you can't just blame the fact that there was no modern science, no modern medicine. I don't know. But that's just what occurred to me. He's like, yeah, all this could have probably been prevented if he had have just got a mental health care plan from the local GP and gone and, you know, followed the course of action recommended. Starfall 15 said, my favourite character is Harriton. His insistence on not taking revenge or even being cross with Heathcliff breaks this generational cycle of vengeance. He's such a decent, sensitive person, and his relationship with Heathcliff is most interesting. I wish we had more scenes with them together. Sorry, whacked the microphone there. I wish we had more scenes with them together. As for Catherine, I thought in the last chapter she did some growing up, but the dinner scene, poking the bear, Heathcliff, wasn't very mature of her. As for Heathcliff, I feel since the death of Edgar and him taking over the Grange, he lost his incentive. All the people who, according to him, remind him of his loss were dead. What is the point of inflicting more misery on Cathy or Harriton, with their parents not here to witness it? He came to realize all this won't make him forget Catherine. New obsession is taking place over the older one to reunite with Catherine. I have a single wish, and my whole being and faculties are yearning to attain it. Simply, he lost the will to live. And it looks like it's having its effect. It looks like he is actually killing himself by just giving up on living, losing the will to live. I do agree, Starfall, that Catherine acted immature at that dinner, provoking Heathcliff in that way and insisting that Harriton will fight on her side. And again, she doesn't seem very considerate of Harriton at all. She's not worrying about, does he want to fight his own father figure? You don't just kind of insist that someone fights for you. I don't know. Honestly, I haven't really seen many redeeming moments for Cathy. I know she's being nice now to Harriton, but I see her niceness almost happening in a selfish way. Or like there's no consequences for her past actions, and she's not acknowledging all the wrongs that she's done, all the mean things that she's done. and she's not acknowledging that she needs to grow up a bit. So, yeah, I'm not that impressed with her, to be honest. We've got one chapter to go, though, so hey, maybe things will turn around. Maybe she will redeem herself at the last moment. Otherwise, I think, Harriton, you can do better, frankly. Maybe not in that hellhole of a place. You might need to travel somewhere else, but I think you can do better. Something that I was thinking about, guys, just in terms of running the conversation, is sometimes I struggle a bit to think of conversation prompts. You can probably tell because often they're not very good, the ones that I say. And then as I read the comments, I'm like, oh, that's a really interesting sort of thing to focus on, that what you commented on. I should have asked a question expanding on that. And I think that just about every day as I read the comments, I'm like, yep, that would have been a good question to ask, something around that little aspect of the chapter. So what I was thinking as a little solution to that, which, because let's be honest, I'm not going to solve that problem by getting better at asking discussion prompts. I'm just not very good at it. I do my best, but I think they're good jumping off points, the ones I ask, because they're always very simplistic. The solution I had in mind was maybe we could do something like, for every time you write a comment in the discussion prompt, answering one or all of the questions that I've asked, you also add at the end of your comment a question of your own. And hopefully creating mini discussions that happen under your comment, or furthering the conversation, I should say, not really mini discussions, it's all one big one. But furthering the conversation in that way. So we might, if we have not really a strict rule, but a bit of a request, really, that if you can ask a question at the end of your comment to further the conversation, chuck another question on there, and maybe we might get a little bit deeper conversations. What do you think of that idea? Answer a question, ask a question. Or even like answer three questions, ask one question. You don't have to ask one question for every one you answer, but I just mean if you are going to make a comment and hit on some of the discussion prompts that I've asked, maybe finish off your comment with a question of your own for everyone else. Let me know what you think of that idea in today's discussion. All right, that's all said. I think let's do this thing. Let's read the final chapter of Wuthering Heights by Emily Bronte, chapter 34, which goes exactly like this. For some days after that evening, Mr. Heathcliff shunned meeting us at meals. Yet he would not consent formally to exclude Harriton and Cathy. He had an aversion to yielding so completely to his feelings, choosing rather to absent himself, and eating once in 24 hours seemed sufficient sustenance for him. One night, after the family were in bed, I heard him go downstairs and out at the front door. I did not hear him re-enter, and in the morning I found he was still away. We were in April then. The weather was sweet and warm, and the grass as green as showers and sun could make it, and the two dwarf apple trees near the southern wall in full bloom. After breakfast, Catherine insisted on my bringing a chair and sitting with my work under the fir trees at the end of the house, and she beguiled Harriton, who had perfectly recovered from his accident, to dig and arrange her little garden, which was shifted to that corner by the influence of Joseph's complaints. I was comfortably revelling in the spring fragrance around and the beautiful soft blue overhead, when my young lady, who had run down near the gate to procure some primrose roots for a border, returned only half laden, and informed us that Mr. Heathcliff was coming in, and he spoke to me, she added, with a perplexed countenance. "What did he say?" asked Harriton. "He told me to be gone as fast as I could," she answered, "but he looked so different from his usual look that I stopped a moment to stare at him." "How?" he inquired. "Why, almost bright and cheerful, no, almost nothing, very much excited and wild and glad," she replied. "Night walking amuses him, then," I remarked, affecting a careless manner. In reality, as surprised as she was, and anxious to ascertain the truth of her statement, for to see the master looking glad would not be an everyday spectacle. I framed an excuse to go in. Heathcliff stood at the open door. He was pale, and he trembled, yet certainly he had a strange, joyful glitter in his eyes that altered the aspect of his whole face. "Will you have some breakfast?" I said. "You must be hungry, rambling about all night." I wanted to discover where he had been, but I did not like to ask directly. "No, I'm not hungry," he answered, averting his head, and speaking rather contemptuously, as if he guessed I was trying to divine the occasion of his good humour. I felt perplexed. I didn't know whether it were not a proper opportunity to offer a bit of admonition. "I don't think it right to wander out of doors," I observed. "Instead of being in bed, it is not wise, at any rate, this moist season." "I dare say you'll catch a bad cold or a fever. You have never the matter with you now." "Nothing but what I can bear," he replied, "and with the greatest pleasure, provided you'll leave me alone. Get in and don't annoy me." I obeyed, and in passing I noticed he breathed as fast as a cat. "Yes," I reflected to myself, "we shall have a fit of illness. I cannot conceive what he has been doing." That noon he sat down to dinner with us, and received a heaped-up plate from my hands, as if he intended to make amends for previous fasting. "I've neither cold nor fever, Nelly," he remarked in allusion to my morning's speech, "and I'm ready to do justice to the food you give me." He took his knife and fork and was going to commence eating when the inclination appeared to become suddenly extinct. He laid them on the table, looking eagerly towards the window, then rose and went out. We saw him walking to and fro in the garden while we concluded our meal, and Earnshaw said he'd go and ask why he would not dine. He thought we had grieved him in some way. "Well, is he coming?" cried Catherine, when her cousin returned. "Nay," he answered. "But he's not angry. He seemed rarely pleased indeed, only I made him impatient by speaking to him twice, and then he bid me be off to you. He wondered how I could want the company of anybody else." I set his plate to keep warm on the fender, and after an hour or two he re-entered. When the room was clear, in no degree calmer, the same unnatural appearance of joy under his black brows, the same bloodless hue, and his teeth visible, now and then in a kind of smile, his frame shivering, not as one shivers with chill or weakness, but as a tight-stretched cord vibrates a strong thrilling rather than trembling. "I will ask what is the matter, I thought, "or who should?" And I exclaimed, "Have you heard any good news, Mr. Heathcliff? You look uncommonly animated." "Where should good news come from to me?" he said. "I am animated with hunger, and seemingly I must not eat." "Your dinner is here," I returned. "Why won't you get it?" "I don't want it now," he muttered hastily. "I'll wait till supper. And, Nelly, once and for all, let me beg you to warn Harriton and the other away from me. I wish to be troubled by nobody. I wish to have this place to myself." "Is there some reason for this banishment?" I inquired. "Tell me why you are so queer, Mr. Heathcliff. Where were you last night? I'm not putting the question through idle curiosity, but..." "You are putting the question through very idle curiosity," he interrupted with a laugh. "Yet I'll answer it. Last night I was on the threshold of hell. Today I am within sight of my heaven. I have my eyes on it, hardly 3 feet to sever me. And now you'd better go. You'll neither see nor hear anything to frighten you, if you refrain from prying." Having swept the hearth and wiped the table, I departed, more perplexed than ever. He did not quit the house again that afternoon, and no one intruded on his solitude till 8 at night. I deemed it proper, though unsummoned, to carry a candle and his supper to him. He was leaning against the ledge of an open lattice, but not looking out. His face was turned to the interior gloom, The fire had smouldered to ashes, the room was filled with the damp, mild air of the cloudy evening, and so still that not only the murmur of the beck down Gimmerton was distinguishable, but its ripples and its gurgling over the pebbles, or through the large stones which it could not cover. I uttered an ejaculation of discontent at seeing the dismal grate, and commenced shutting the casements, one after another, till I came to his. "Must I close this?" I asked, in order to rouse him, for he would not stir. The light flashed on his features as I spoke. Oh, Mr. Lockwood, I cannot express what a terrible start I got by the momentary view. Those deep black eyes, that smile, and ghastly paleness, it appeared to me, not Mr. Heathcliff, but a goblin, and in my terror I let the candle bend towards the wall, and it left me in darkness. "Yes, close it," he replied in his familiar voice. "There, that pure awkwardness. Why did you hold the candle horizontally? Be quick and bring another." I hurried out in a foolish state of dread, and said to Joseph, "The master wishes you to take him a light and rekindle the fire." For I dared not go in myself again just then. Joseph rattled some fire into the shovel and went, but he brought it back immediately with the supper tray in his other hand, explaining that Mr. Heathcliff was going to bed, and he wanted nothing to eat till morning. We heard him mount the stairs directly. He did not proceed to his ordinary chamber, but turned into that with the panelled bed. Its window, as I mentioned before, is wide enough for anybody to get through, and it struck me that he plotted another midnight excursion, of which he had rather we had no suspicion. "Is he a ghoul or a vampire?" I mused. I had read of such hideous incarnate demons, and then I set myself to reflect how I had tended him in infancy, and watched him grow to youth, and followed him almost through his whole course, and what absurd nonsense it was to yield to that sense of horror. "But where did he come from, that little dark thing harboured by a good man to his bane?" muttered superstition as I dozed into unconsciousness, and I began half-dreaming to weary myself with imagining some fit parentage for him, and repeating my waking meditations, I tracked his existence over again with grim variations at last, picturing his death and funeral, of which all I can remember is being exceedingly vexed at having to the task of dictating an inscription for his monument, and consulting the sexton about it, and as he had no surname, and we could not tell his age, we were obliged to content ourselves with the single word Heathcliff that came true, we were. If you enter the kirkyard, you'll read on his headstone only that, and the date of his death. Dawn restored me to common sense. I rose and went into the garden as soon as I could see, to ascertain if there were any footmarks under his window. There were none. "He has stayed at home," I thought, "and he'll be all right today." I prepared breakfast for the household, as was my usual custom, but told Harriton and Catherine to get theirs ere the master came down, for he lay late. They preferred taking it out of doors, under the trees, and I set a little table to accommodate them. On my re-entrance I found Mr. Heathcliff below. He and Joseph were conversing about some farming business. He gave clear, minute directions concerning the matter discussed, but he spoke rapidly, and turned his head continually aside, and he had the same excited expression, even more exaggerated, when Joseph quitted the room. He took his seat in the place he generally chose, and I put a basin of coffee before him. He drew it nearer, and then rested his arms on the table and looked at the opposite wall, as I supposed, surveying one particular portion up and down with glittering restless eyes, and with such eager interest that he stopped breathing during half a minute together. "Come now," I exclaimed, pushing some bread against his hand, "eat and drink that, while it is hot. It has been waiting near an hour." He didn't notice me, and yet he smiled. I'd rather have seen him gnash his teeth than smile so. "Mr. Heathcliff, master," I cried, "don't, for God's sake, stare as if you saw an unearthly vision." "Don't, for God's sake, shout so loud," he replied. "Turn round and tell me, are we by ourselves?" "Of course," was my answer, "of course we are." Still, I involuntarily obeyed him, as if I was not quite sure. With a sweep of his hand, he cleared a vacant space in front among the breakfast things and leant forward to gaze more at his ease. Now I perceived he was not looking at the wall, for when I regarded him alone, it seemed exactly that he gazed at something within 2 yards' distance, and whatever it was, it communicated apparently both pleasure and pain in exquisite extremes. At least the anguished yet raptured expression of his countenance suggested that idea. The fancied object was not fixed either. His eyes pursued it with unwearied diligence, and even in speaking to me, were never weaned away. I vainly reminded him of his protracted abstinence from food, and if he stirred to touch anything in compliance with my entreaties, if he stretched his hand out to get a piece of bread, his fingers clenched before they reached it and remained on the table forgetful of their aim. I sat, a model of patience, trying to attract his absorbed attention from its engrossing speculation till he grew irritable and got up, asking why I would not allow him to have his own time in taking his meals, and saying that on the next occasion I needn't wait, I might set the things down and go. Having uttered these words, he left the house, slowly sauntered down the garden path, and disappeared through the gate. The hours crept anxiously by. Another evening came. I did not retire to rest till late, and when I did, I could not sleep. He returned after midnight, and instead of going to bed, shut himself into the room beneath. I listened and tossed about, and finally dressed and descended. It was too irksome to lie there, harassing my brain with 100 idle misgivings. I distinguished Mr. Heathcliff's step, restlessly measuring the floor, and he frequently broke the silence by a deep inspiration resembling a groan. He muttered detached words also, and the only one I could catch was the name of Catherine, coupled with some wild term of endearment or suffering, and spoken as one would speak to a person present, low and earnest, and wrung from the depth of his soul. I had not courage to walk straight into the apartment, but I desired to divert him from his reverie, and therefore fell foul of the kitchen fire, stirred it, and began to scrape the cinders. It drew him forth sooner than I expected. He opened the door immediately and said, "Nelly, come here, is it morning? Come in with your light." "It is striking 4," I answered. "You want a candle to take upstairs. You might have lit one at this fire." "No, I don't wish to go upstairs," he said. "Come in and kindle me a fire, and do anything there is to do about the room." "I must blow the coals red first before I can carry any," I replied, getting a chair and the bellows. He roamed to and fro meantime in a state of approaching distraction, his heavy sighs succeeding each other so thick as to leave no space for common breathing between. "When day breaks, I'll send for Green," he said. "I wish to make some legal inquiries of him while I can bestow a thought of these matters, and while I can act calmly. I have not written my will yet, and how to leave my property, I cannot determine. I wish I could annihilate it from the face of the earth." "I would not talk so, Mr. Heathcliff," I interposed. "Let your will be a while. You will be spared to repent of your many injustices yet. I never expected that your nerves would be disordered. They are, at present, marvellously so, however, and almost entirely through your own fault. The way you've passed these 3 last days might knock up a Titan. Do take some food, and some repose. You need only look at yourself in a glass to see how you require both. Your cheeks are hollow, and your eyes are bloodshot, like a person starving with hunger and going blind with loss of sleep." "It is not my fault that I cannot eat or rest," he replied. "I assure you it is through no settled designs. I'll do both as soon as I possibly can, but you might as well bid a man struggling in the water rest his arms length of the shore. I must reach it first, and then I'll rest. Well, never mind, Mr. Green, as to repenting of my injustices. I've done no injustice, and I repent of nothing. I'm too happy, and yet I'm not happy enough. My soul's bliss kills my body, but does not satisfy itself." "Happy, master," I cried. "Strange happiness, if you would hear me without being angry. I might offer some advice that would make you happier." "What is that?" he asked. "Give it." "You are aware, Mr. Heathcliff," I said, "that from the time you were 13 years old you have lived a selfish, unchristian life, and probably hardly had a Bible in your hands during all that period. You must have forgotten the contents of the book, and you may not have space to search it now. Could it be hurtful to send for someone, some minister of any denomination, it does not matter which, to explain it, and show you how very far you have erred from its precepts, and how unfit you will be for its heaven, unless a change takes place before you die?" "I'm rather obliged than angry, Nelly," he said, "for you remind me of the manner in which I desire to be buried. It is to be carried to the churchyard in the evening. You and Harriton may, if you please, accompany me, and mind, particularly, to notice that the sexton obeys my directions concerning the two coffins. No minister need come, nor need anything to be said over me. I tell you, I have nearly attained my heaven, and that of others is altogether unvalued and uncovered by me. And supposing you persevere in your obstinate fast, and die by that means, and they refuse to bury you in the precincts of the kirk," I said, shocked at his godless indifference, "how would you like it?" "They won't do that," he replied. If they did, you must have removed secretly. You must have me removed secretly, and if you neglect it, you shall prove practically that the dead are not annihilated." As soon as he heard the other members of the family stirring, he retired to his den, and I breathed freer. But in the afternoon, while Joseph and Harriton were at their work, he came into the kitchen again, and with a wild look, bid me come and sit in the house. He wanted somebody with him. I declined, telling him plainly that his strange talk and manner frightened me, and I had neither the nerve nor the will to be his companion alone. "I believe you think me a fiend," he said, with his dismal laugh, "something too horrible to live under a decent roof." Then turning to Catherine, who was there, and who drew behind me at his approach, he added, half sneeringly, "Will you come, Chuck? I'll not hurt you. No, to you I've made myself worse than the devil. Well, there is one who won't shrink from my company. By God, she's relentless. Oh, damn it, it's unutterably too much for flesh and blood to bear, even mine." He solicited the society of no one more. At dusk he went into his chamber. Through the whole night and far into the morning we heard him groaning and murmuring to himself. Harriton was anxious to enter, but I bid him fetch Mr. Kenneth, and he should go in and see him. When he came, I requested admittance, and tried to open the door. I found it locked, and Heathcliff bid us be damned. He was better, and would be left alone, so the doctor went away. The following evening was very wet. Indeed, it poured down till day dawn, and as I took my morning walk round the house, I observed the master's window swinging open, and the rain driving straight in. "He cannot be in bed," I thought. "Those showers would drench him through. He must either be up or out. But I'll make no more ado. I'll go boldly and look." Having succeeded in obtaining entrance with another key, I ran to unclose the panels, for the chamber was vacant. Quickly pushing them aside, I peeped in. Mr. Heathcliff was there, laid on his back. His eyes met mine, so keen and fierce. I started, and then he seemed to smile. I could not think him dead, but his face and throat were washed with rain. The bedclothes dripped, and he was perfectly still. The lattice, flapping to and fro, had grazed one hand that rested on the sill. No blood trickled from the broken skin, and when I put my fingers to it, I could doubt no more. He was dead and stark. I hasped the window. I combed his black long hair from his forehead. I tried to close his eyes to extinguish, if possible, that frightful, lifelike gaze of exultation before anyone else beheld it. They would not shut. They seemed to sneer at my attempts, and his parted lips and sharp white teeth sneered too. Taken with another fit of cowardice, I cried out for Joseph. Joseph shuffled up and made a noise, but resolutely refused to meddle with him. "The devil's hurried off his soul," he cried, and he may have his carcass into the bargain for aught I care. Eck, what a wicked un he looks, groaning at death. And the old sinner grinned in mockery. I thought he intended to cut a caper round the bed, but suddenly composing himself, he fell on his knees and raised his hands and returned thanks that the lawful master and the ancient stock were restored to their rights. I felt stunned by the awful event, and my memory of unavoidably recurred to former times with a sort of oppressive sadness. But poor Harriton, the most wronged, was the only one who really suffered much. He sat by the corpse all night, weeping in bitter earnest. He pressed its hand and kissed the sarcastic savage face that everyone else shrank from contemplating, and bemoaned him with that strong grief which springs naturally from a generous heart, though it be tough as tempered steel. Mr. Kenneth was perplexed to pronounce of what disorder the master died. I concealed the fact of his having swallowed nothing for 4 days, fearing it might lead to trouble, and then I am persuaded he did not abstain on purpose. It was the consequence of his strange illness, not the cause. We buried him to the scandal of the whole neighbourhood as he wished. Earnshaw and I, the sexton and 6 men to carry the coffin, comprehended the whole attendance. The 6 men departed when they had left it down into the grave. We stayed to see it covered. Harriton, with a streaming face, dug green sods and laid them over the brown mould itself. At present it was as smooth and verdant as its companion mounds, and I hope its tenant sleeps as soundly. But the country folks, if you ask them, would swear on the Bible that he walks. There are those who speak to having met him near the church, and on the moor, and even within this house. Idle tales, you'll say, and so I say. Yet the old man by the kitchen fire affirms he has seen 2 on 'em looking out of his chamber window on every rainy night since his death, and an odd thing happened to me about a month ago. I was going to the Grange one evening, a dark evening, threatening thunder, and just at the turn of the heights I encountered a little boy with a sheep and 2 lambs before him. He was crying terribly, and I supposed the lambs were skittish and would not be guided. "What is the matter, my little man?" I asked. "There's Heathcliff and a woman yonder, under to nab," he blubbered, "when I durnot pass 'em." I saw nothing, but neither the sheep nor he would go on, so I bid him take the road lower. He probably raised the phantoms from thinking, as he traversed the moors alone, on the nonsense he had heard his parents and companions repeat. Yet still I don't like being out in the dark now, and I don't like being left by myself in this grim house. I cannot help it. I shall be glad when they leave it, and shift to the Grange. "They are going to the Grange, then," I said. "Yes," answered Mrs. Dean, "as soon as they are married, and that will be on New Year's Day."
"And who will live here, then?"
"Why, Joseph will take care of the house, and perhaps a lad to keep him company. They will live in the kitchen, and the rest will be shut up."
"For the use of such ghosts as choose to inhabit it," I observed.
"No, Mr. Lockwood," said Nellie, shaking her head. "I believe the dead are at peace, but it is not right to speak of them with levity." At that moment, the garden gate swung to. The ramblers were returning. "They are afraid of nothing," I grumbled, watching their approach through the window. "Together they would brave Satan and all his legions." As they stepped onto the doorstones and halted to take a last look at the moon, or more correctly at each other by her light, I felt irresistibly impelled to escape them again, and pressing a remembrance into the hand of Mrs. Dean, and disregarding her expostulations at my rudeness, I vanished through the kitchen as they opened the house door, and so should have confirmed Joseph in his opinion of his fellow servant's gay indiscretions, had he not fortunately recognized me as a respectable character by the sweat ring of a sovereign at his feet. The sweet ring of a sovereign at his feet. My walk home was lengthened by a diversion in the direction of the kirk. When beneath its walls I perceived decay had made progress, even in 7 months, many a window showed black gaps deprived of glass, and slates jutted off here and there beyond the right line of the roof, and to be gradually worked off in coming autumn storms. I sought and soon discovered the 3 headstones on the slope next to the moor.
the middle one grey. And, half buried in the heath, Edgar Linton's only harmonised by the turf and moss creeping up its foot, Heathcliff's still bare. I lingered round them, under the benign sky, watched the moths fluttering among the heath and harebells, listened to the soft wind breathing through the grass, and wondered how anyone could ever imagine unquiet slumbers for the sleepers in that quiet earth. The end. There you go. That is Wuthering Heights finished. I am not even going to reflect on it yet. I'm going to save everything for the wrap-up episode. Have your say about this chapter and this whole book over at reddit.com/r/thehemingwaylist. I do very much look forward to reading your thoughts on this book. Thank you for listening today, and I will see you tomorrow twice, once for the recap episode and a second time to kick off The Brothers Karamazov. Thanks for listening. See you then.